Please be seated. Well, good morning. We've added quite a few people since our last case. The notes that I've been given tell me that St. Joseph's Catholic Academy is with us. If students are with us, would they and their advisors please stand? Oh, very nice. Very nice. Thank you. You may be seated. The students are here on a program called Court with Class, so they've had the opportunity to have the issues described and have received some information about it. And when this argument is concluded, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, who sits here to my left, will meet with the students in the courtroom to answer questions. She won't talk about the substance of the case that we're about to hear, but rather how cases get to the Supreme Court and other types of procedural questions. So welcome and thank you very much for joining us. Let me see what else we have here. Okay, so you have a little different lineup time-wise. So I'd like to go over it so that I know that we're all on the same page and that what I have is correct. Beginning, Attorney Rogers, you're going to have 25 minutes. Is that correct? Okay. And then Attorney Enkley, am I saying your name correctly?
Enkley.
Oh, sorry, I'm looking the wrong way. Okay. Say it again. Enkley. Sounds like a good Norwegian name. Okay. The name like Rogensack, you would think I could pronounce everything, but I have never managed to do that. Then we're going to go to Dustin Wohl, and you will have 25 minutes, and then back again to you, Attorney Rogers. Is that correct? Okay. I will then call the case, Engelhardt versus City of New Berlin, and if you are ready to proceed, please do.
May it please the court. My name is Chris Rogers, and I am here with my partner, Jesse Blocker.
Could you speak more directly into the microphone?
Sure. My name is Chris Rogers, and I'm here with my partner, Jesse Blocker. We represent Michael and Julianne Engelhardt individually, and Julianne Engelhardt as the personal representative of the estate of Lily Engelhardt. As you know, this case stems from a tragedy at the Weiberg Pool in Brookfield, Wisconsin. It occurred on June 4th, 2014. At that point, Lily Engelhardt was eight years old, and she lost her life in a drowning incident. Lily was participating in the City of New Berlin's summer recreation program. It was Lily's second day attending the program, and it was her first day at the Weiberg Pool. As our brief lays out, we are making three main points today. Number one, I stand before you and respectfully request that the court revisit the application of governmental immunity and tort actions in this state and to restore the Holitz finding in 893-80 sub 4 to its original intent.
Well, what do you mean by restore Holitz?
I believe, Your Honor, that the Holitz ruling has been abrogated by subsequent case law.
Okay, well, first you have to tell me what you think Holitz ruling is.
I believe that the Holitz ruling was that for general tort claims, liability is the norm and immunity is the exception. I believe since that point in time, subsequent case law that has interpreted Holitz in 893-80 sub 4 has made immunity the exception, the main force, and liability the exception.
Counsel, maybe people have confused those rules between state liability and other entities' liability, because as I read the cases, I think there is a difference, right?
I read the cases as, with regard to Holitz, covering both state and municipal actors, Your Honor. And
State and municipal?
And municipal actors, I believe. I still believe there can be, obviously, immunity with regard to the state actors, but I believe that the Holitz case applied to both state and municipal actors.
Two questions. Cords. Why are you going back to Holitz when you have Cords? Doesn't Cords work in your favor?
Cords does work in our favor to a certain extent, but I wanted to, with regard to Cords and Holitz, underscore the point that the discrepancies in the definitions of the cases are such that we no longer have the underscored meaning of what Holitz presented.
Let me ask you this. What I'd like to hear from you is how you tie together the ministerial duty and where in the various documents and things you find that. Can you give me your best argument in that regard?
Your Honor, just for point of clarification, with regard to the documents involving New Berlin.
Give me your best argument on why there's a ministerial duty. With precision.
There's a ministerial duty here that was created by not only the common law, but by the documents that were provided and created by New Berlin.
Okay, now give me, when you're talking about the documents, give me chapter and verse.
Okay. The staff guidelines, as well as the brochure and handbook, and as well as the Worth Aquatic rules and records themselves. With regard to the staff guidelines, while it says guidelines, the titles are not dispositive per LODL, and they specifically create ministerial duties. It states, it is your responsibility to supervise the kids at all times. It's an absolute rule. For example, during your weekly swimming field trips, it also states to make sure you know where the kids are in your care at all times. These are absolute rules, more specific than in PREES, I would argue. Additionally, the staff handbook talks about enforcing and explaining all facility rules and regulations. That includes the Weiberg rules, and one of the Weiberg rules states that that Weiberg is indeed providing lifeguards. However, when you bring in 64 to 74 new kids from a rec program that New Berlin has, the Weiberg rules specifically say that the Weiberg lifeguards do not take over for the constant supervision of the New Berlin staff of their kids. It cannot stand in the place of the constant supervision of their kids. Furthermore, the Weiberg rules state that you need to present the Weiberg rules while on the site, and presumably that was so that you could point out the specific rules for the shallow pool, for the deep end of the pool, for the splash pad, and what have you. And that was not done. In addition, there was an information packet or a brochure that was sent to the families of New Berlin, of the folks that participated in the rec program. We think all of these together are acts of government. And with regard to the information packets, it specifically stated that the participants will be divided into small groups, which would be with the leader for the duration of the day. There is a question of fact of whether they actually occurred and whether there was a small group differentiated or not. Pieces of the record that suggest that the 74 kids that were there that day were only broken down into two kids, male and female. Secondly, there's testimony in the record that make it clear that there was no leader assigned to specific kids or the small groups.
Should we be sending this back for some sort of hearing then?
I think Your Honor, that there are questions of fact in the record here with regard to substantive facts about whether the rules were, what portions of the rules were adhered to and what portions of the rules were not adhered to.
This was done on summary judgment.
It was. It was in front of Judge Davis in Waukesha County.
So you're objecting to the fact that summary judgment is not appropriate.
Well, we prevailed.
Unless it was in your favor.
It wasn't.
Prevailed at summary judgment, and then an interlocutory appeal took it up to the Second District Court of Appeals, and that's how we got here today.
Mm-hmm. Counsel, your concern is not with the rules as they exist. It's the implementation of the rules. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
All right. And when you say that we should go back to Holitz in 893-80, are you referring simply to the proposition that immunity should be the exception to the rule, or are you referring to the classifications for immunity that are contained in the statute and were discussed in Holitz?
The latter, Your Honor. I think one of the things that created Holitz, or what Holitz stemmed out of, was the myriad of classifications for immunity and non-immunity, proprietary versus governmental, for instance. If this case were in 1961, I believe that it would be actionable at the circuit court because it would fit as a proprietary action. So I think not only do we make immunity the exception and liability the rule, but I think Holitz got rid of some of those, or attempted to get rid of some of those kind of amorphous, inconsistent categories.
As you know, Council 893-80 speaks in terms of immunity for legislative and quasi-legislative and judicial and quasi-judicial functions. Are there any legislative or quasi-legislative functions involved in this case?
With regard to the underlying action, it is a general tort. And with regard to that general tort, I do not believe that it is quasi-judicial or quasi-legislative.
What's the underlying act that you're talking about?
I'm sorry.
What is the underlying act you're talking about?
The proposed negligence of New Berlin in overseeing and supervising the kids that were in its charge. I do think there are at least arguably judicial and quasi-judicial portions here. If there was a policy planning or an accounting or an analysis of what the rules were in the first instance, I believe that that would be a ministerial act. But once we get to the actual rules, this is a general tort claim. And even if we utilize the current state of 893-80 sub 4, I believe that ministerial acts were created.
All right, so if I understand correctly, your concern is with how the rules were carried out, yes?
That's true.
Okay. And the statute, 893-80, refers to, in terms, two of our three branches of government, right? It posits immunity for legislative acts and quasi-legislative acts, judicial acts and quasi-judicial acts. But it does not provide for immunity for executive or quasi-executive acts, right?
If I heard you right, you stated that it does not provide immunity for quasi-judicial and quasi-legislative acts.
Does not provide immunity for executive or quasi-executive functions, right?
It is not stated as such in the statute.
Okay. And would it be fair to characterize the lifeguards and other supervising personnel as carrying out or otherwise executing the policies that have been adopted by the county?
That have been adopted by?
The county.
The county?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I believe that's exactly what has happened here.
All right. So if those are executive functions, supervising, And the statute does not provide immunity for executive functions, then there'd be no immunity in this case.
Well, I think for the municipalities, I think respondeat superior applies where there's vicarious liability for the actions of the employees. And I think in this situation, for a general tort.
Yep. But those employees were acting in an executive capacity, not a legislative or judicial capacity, right?
I don't know if they were, it's a difficult question for me to answer. I don't know if they were specifically acting as in an executive capacity. I think they were following the rules of the New Berlin municipality.
Counsel, can I step in here, Justice Kelly? As I understand your argument, you've got two separate strains of an argument. One kind of follows, I think, my dissent in Melkert case from last term, where I basically laid out my view of the statute that when it's talking about legislative and judicial or quasi-legislative or quasi-judicial functions, that we should be looking at immunizing from liability officials who are acting in those capacities in the traditional sense. But in this case, we have college students and some adults supervising kids in a day camp, right?
Correct. Recreational day camp.
And in Melkert, we were dealing with a installation of a light pole. So my question is, you're arguing two things because I think the case law has, in this state, when it's interpreting governmental immunity statute, has, in my view, gone far beyond what legislative and judicial functions really are, and it's immunizing government acts that are tortious in nature. And that's, so you're arguing two different things here. And I think I'm stepping in here because I think what Justice Kelly is trying to get at is whether the actions here that we're looking at had more of an executive character, because that's our third branch of government, the executive, and there is no immunity in the statute.
Right. I understand the idea of the executive branch and sovereign immunity. I think this is more in the, if it's going to be categorized, it's categorized in the legislative or quasi-judicial or quasi-legislative. I don't believe it's an executive branch, but I don't believe that these actions fit under the definition that is currently on the books for what those terms mean.
Which terms?
Judicial and quasi-judicial. I think those terms have created an aspect of a ministerial. And I apologize. I think I'm missing your point. But
I guess what I'm getting at is your first argument could be that, look, court, you've gotten it wrong for decades, and none of these actions, installing a light pole, supervising kids at a pool, has nothing to do with the legislature or the judiciary. It's not even quasi-legislative or judicial. However, your second argument is that, okay, if you are going to continue to apply this framework, then these are purely ministerial duties to which immunity does not attach.
Right, and I may not have made that clear to my answer to Justice Kelly, but I think under the current rulings and interpretation of those terms, I think a ministerial duty has been created here, has been created with the documents and with all, and collected as a whole, including the Weiberg documents. I do believe that the ministerial duty was created.
Does an open body of water with a known non-swimmer create any kind of a ministerial duty for the municipality?
I think it does. I think it's a factual basis test. So in this case, there was a compelling danger that was known by New Berlin. New Berlin was put on notice of the danger. The day before the incident, Julianne Englehart went and spoke with New Berlin and said, "My daughter can't swim. I'm not sure she should even go to this event." It was her first exposure to a rec program the day before. It was her first exposure to the Wyberg pool the next day.
I don't want to stop you, so I want to ask a question when you're finished. So please finish if you're not.
That put New Berlin on notice. She was an 8-year-old girl. The fact that she was 8 and a little older and unable to swim, I think that's an important fact as well. She had no history with Wyberg Pool. She had presumably no idea where the deep end or where the pools were. And this is close to being an accident waiting to happen. There was such a concern that it was voiced to New Berlin, and the New Berlin director said, "Don't worry, we're going to keep her safe. We're going to keep her out of the deep end of the pool." And I think for this particular plaintiff, this particular party, created a known and compelling danger that required an act to be done by New Berlin. What it couldn't do is do nothing. And that is exactly what happened here. They didn't follow their rules. They didn't keep her from going into the water. They didn't do a swim test. They didn't know where she was. And so I believe that there was a compelling danger exception that applied here.
Counsel, I return to the threshold question asked by Justice Ziegler when she, in essence, asked, "Why are you talking about hollets? Why are you not talking about cords?" And in 2009, I think it was, yes, in the Umansky case, we discussed what does the known danger exception to immunity mean. And referencing cords, the opinion in part states, "That exception set forth in Cords versus Anderson is present where the nature of the danger is compelling and known to the officer and is of such force that the public officer has no discretion not to act. The known danger exception has been reserved for situations that are more than unsafe when the danger is so severe and so immediate that a response is demanded." Your response to the prior question seemed to put life into that test. And in fact, it seemed to me that you were using the very words set forth in Umansky about what constitutes the known danger exception. So, let me repeat Justice Ziegler's question. Why are you talking about hollets and why don't you talk about cords?
Well, I believe cords is on point, Your Honor, and I believe we cited it in our case, and I believe it does support the known danger argument.
Counsel, the response to a known danger, isn't it to prevent the public from coming in contact with it?
The known danger exception, if there is a known danger, then you either have to negate the danger or take proactive steps to protect from the danger. And in this case, neither was done.
Wouldn't, if this is a known danger, wouldn't that require keeping the kids away from the pool entirely?
I didn't hear your last point, Your Honor, but...
Wouldn't it require keeping the kids away from the pool entirely if this is a known danger?
Well, I think I think there's discretion into how to protect from the known danger, and that would certainly be one of them. But when there is a known danger that exists, what you can't do is nothing, as the Hauser case, I believe, spoke of. So if they would have followed their rules or engaged in other rulemaking, buddy system, actually having a New Berlin staff member be accountable for specific kids, you could have reacted to the known danger. But in this case, specifically as Julianne Engelhardt, Lily's mother, put them on notice, that certainly in her opinion this was a known danger to the point where she was afraid or at least uttered some concerns to even go to the pool.
So
what was the... I'm sorry.
That's okay. Can I follow up? Mm-hmm. So with respect to the known danger exception, Mr. Rogers, though, in the past, hasn't it been reserved for situations where we didn't just have the issue of it being unsafe, but where it was severe and immediate and the response seemed to be non-discretionary? Would this be an expansion then of that exception in your mind that we set forth in Cords and other cases? Because, I mean, in Numansky, there was a footnote that basically talked about how maybe the falling from this platform to his death was not something that was so immediate despite those terrible circumstances. So are you advocating for really an expansion of that doctrine?
No, I'm not. I think in this case, in light of the fact that Lily had no background or history with this pool, that she had no ability to swim, that she appeared more proficient in all likelihood because of her age than she was, I think this is a known and compelling danger for Lily.
And it doesn't matter then how they acted, as long as they acted in some way. The fact that they could have done various things. This isn't a situation like Cords where you only you have one way of acting to prevent the known danger. They could have kept her in the locker room. They could have tested her swimming. So that doesn't matter?
Well, I think if you undertake an action, that decision in all likelihood may create immunity. But what you can't do is per Hauser, what you can't do is do nothing if you're presented with a known danger. And in this case, the argument is that's exactly what they did, at least specifically with regard to Lily Engelhardt.
Right, but that's not quite enough, though, right? So the known danger doctrine implicates the ministerial versus discretionary dichotomy, right? And what we're trying to get to then is figuring out if this fits. What was the non-discretionary ministerial thing that they were required to do in this circumstance? So we know it's got to be something more than nothing. But it's got to be really specific. It's got to be something that the rule tells them, you must do X. So what's the X?
Yeah, and that is to constantly supervise the children. Don't let them be in the pool by themselves. Know where they are at all times. Be in the pool. Have your feet in the pool. Utilize the Weiberg rules. Those are actions that they, per rule, were to undertake and at least arguably did not take them. And in fact, at least it's our position that when you look at the facts as a whole, they did none of those things. In fact, did nothing to assure that she was protected from a known danger for her. Oh, I apologize. The red light's on.
That's fine.
Good morning. My name is Kyle Engelke. Together with Ted Waskowski at Stafford Rosenbaum, we represent the League of Wisconsin Municipalities, the Towns Association, and the Counties Association. And we filed an amicus on one issue. And the issue is whether or not the test for discretionary immunity applies in a case such as here, where 893-80 is at issue. And this case involves a complaint about what the defendant failed to do to prevent a drowning in July 2012. And there can be much discussion about what facts or cases or the development of the law has led us to the point in July 2012 when this tragedy occurred. However, what's clear is that just a few months before the drowning in July 2012, there was recognition by the legislature on what the standard applied. And that standard was that there's discretionary immunity for governmental actors under 893-80. And in fact, the legislature acted in reliance upon that standard when passing Wisconsin 2011 Act 132, because there used to be a ministerial duty created by the defect statute, the highway defect statute in 893-83. And there the legislature recognized and acted upon removing that ministerial duty so that there would be discretion that applies to those decisions. So the arguments that I'll make here today all lead back to that singular point, that you really could not ask for a more clear statement of what the legislature anticipated 893-80 to mean, that is temporal and clear that it was discretionary in July 2012. And now to address basically the small points that were outside the briefing, because we only get 3,000 words, I think there was one reference to a case called Wanky in the plaintiff's reply brief that was not addressed in the amicus brief. And there, I just want to distinguish the case because there was a reference to the fact that there was inaction by the legislature. And if there's inaction, that doesn't constitute acquiescence, or not as strong as acquiescence. But I would point out that even in Wanky, in paragraph, I think it's 37, they talk about the positive demonstration by the legislature of their understanding of the law.
What do you exactly want our opinion to say? If you were drafting it, what would you say in favor of your client?
On behalf of the municipal parties that I represent, I would have...
That's why you're here, right?
Okay. Exactly, Your Honor. I would have the decision apply the longstanding precedent that discretionary acts are legislative, judicial, quasi-legislative, and quasi-judicial. That's the precedent that I would ask the court to apply to this case, which in fact does apply, based on what the legislature has done in reliance on the court's decisions throughout the last 50, 60 years.
They'll stay with precedent.
Yes, yes.
And discretionary acts are quasi-legislative.
Yes.
That's about as close as you can get, right?
Yes.
And it's not close, it's not that close.
Well, I guess I don't know exactly what you mean by close but not close.
Well, it's not quasi-legislative.
What is not? I'm sorry, Your Honor.
The discretionary act here. It's not. It's an executive act.
Okay.
Do you disagree?
My response to that point, I think that there was a discussion of executive acts earlier. I think Justice Kelly
right.
rose it. And there is not the term executive act
right.
in a statute. However, I think what is clear is that there has been a longstanding interpretation of what constitutes legislative and judicial, and whether it's quasi or not, that extends to the executive branch. And so that would apply just as it does to legislative or judicial decisions to, I guess, what may or may not be constituted as an executive decision.
Well, should we overrule all these decisions that aren't tied to the language of the act?
What about the language of the act?
Shall we overrule or re-explain decisions that are not tied to the words of the statute?
I believe that the court should apply the precedent it has, so it should apply the language in the act. And again, just to the extent that there are disputes about what facts constitute what standard, again, the court ruled on what that was back in Pliets and have interpreted since in, you know, all the seminal cases cited and argued by the briefs. And I would point also that, you know, there's a concern that there's a difficulty rectifying all these cases and looking at them. I can understand that struggle. Of course, that's the Supreme Court's role. But I would just point out that in the briefing, I think I counted about 26 or 27 cases looking at what constitutes a discretionary act. And I think about a dozen of them found that there was no immunity. And so it's not that it is difficult decisions, of course, but again, everything returns back to the recognition in 2011, which was the effective act in 2012, on what the legislature said the state of the law was.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Dustin Wohl, and I represent New Berlin and the New Berlin Parks and Recreation Department. Before I go into my canned speech, I just wanted to hit on some of the topics that were discussed recently. My primary argument is not in defending the law as it is. I know previously the court had thought that the league would be an ideal amicus to hear from, and that is what that amicus addressed, although I do agree not to rock the boat, so to speak. I did want to just mention a few things that are pertinent to that discussion, though, in some of the cases. In Holyoke, you know, they did partially abrogate immunity, but they had a reservation for legislative, quasi-legislative, judicial, quasi-judicial. They never explained what that meant. The court has done its best over the decades to try to put meaning into that. The legislature has been aware of that and has acquiesced in that. So I think what we have here is judicial respect not only for government, local government, but also for the legislature. There was some thought, and it's come through these cases, there was an idea that quasi-judicial, quasi-legislative meant or had to do with discretion and exercise of discretion. That appears in some of the old cases. The main one is the Myers case.
What year is Myers?
I believe it was 1955, but I don't know offhand. And that's a good point. I don't know if Your Honor is pointing out that it was before Holyoke's.
That's
clearly
exactly it.
My point is, if in Holyoke's the court is reserving something and they're using that language, shouldn't we take them to mean by that language what that language meant before? In other words, just because something was part of the test before Holyoke's, that doesn't mean that Holyoke's necessarily wanted to scrap that. So we have to ask ourselves, what means legislative, quasi-legislative, all that? The court didn't do it. The legislature didn't do it when they enacted the statute.
When did the court do it? Post-Holyoke's? What was the first seminal case?
It's been a long line of cases.
Well, how about 1975 in Lister, which was 1 year before I graduated from law school, and I really remember reading that case because I thought it was a seminal case at the time.
It's been bits and pieces. You know, Lister didn't do it all. You've got Lister, you've got Leifer. It's been gradual, and the court has to that point. If we're looking at trying to figure out what the court meant back in the time of Holyoke's, is the court that was familiar with the law and the court that was sitting here in 1975, 1976, are they possibly more intimately familiar with the law of immunity as it existed in the 50s and the 60s than we are today? We might give some respect to the fact that even though it came a decade later, it's still closer in time than we are now.
Let's talk about the law in the 1950s and 60s regarding immunity. Another seminal case, and it was in the early 60s, was the Antonowitz case. And that dealt with immunity of property owners. And there were at that time distinctions between invitees and licensees and trespassers, and what kind of immunity applied, if any, to those categories. And the Antonowitz case changed the whole discussion, except for trespassers. They said, okay, trespassers are still
going to be the subject of immunity for the landowner. But there was an exception. And what was that exception? That exception turned out to be the attractive nuisance exception. The attractive nuisance exception was particularly focused on the quintessential example was the swimming pool in the neighbor's yard vis-a-vis young children. And the question was whether or not, as the law evolved, whether or not Wisconsin was going to adopt the restatement of attractive nuisance doctrine, and we did. And so we said, you know, landowners, you're immune, except in situations that quintessentially would be the swimming pool with the child of tender age that couldn't swim. Subsequently, the legislature in 2012 adopted essentially the attractive nuisance. Now, that's vis-a-vis landowners, you know, not governmental immunity, it's landowner immunity. It was adopted, I think, and codified in what's the statute? 895-529. And part of that statute, consistent with the restatement vis-a-vis attractive nuisance, young children, swimming pools, are these elements set forth in the statute. Again, I'm not saying this is all for us to our case because we're dealing with governmental immunity, but it certainly suggests a legislative policy. It is when the possessor of the real estate had an inherently dangerous condition to children, and it was an unreasonable risk of serious harm. That's sub 3 of that statute. Sub 4, the injured or killed child, because of his or her youth or tender age, did not discover the condition or realize the risk involved in entering into the property or in playing close proximity therewith. Sub 4. Now, sub 5, the possessor of the real estate could have obviated the inherent danger without interfering with the purpose for which the condition was maintained, etc. And so, although it deals with a different kind of immunity, it seems that it's focused and has some analogy, since you mentioned the law of the 60s that got finally codified in 2012 today. So take it from there, counsel. What do you think about that in terms of the policy? And does that have any application to this today? It seemed to me that it does, but I'm uncertain.
Just being introduced to that right now, I would say nope. It's sort of something I hadn't thought about. I don't think so. I think I will give you that in Holyoke. There is some strong rhetoric against sovereign immunity. That leaves us with the question of the words of the decision and the words of the statute. And let me just hit a couple of cases of the older cases that have been cited, because I've got to get out of this and then into application to my clients. In the Drucker case, D-R-U-E-C-K-E-R, that's 21 West 621, and that was cited in recent cases for the difficulty in drawing the line. So that's been cited in the recent cases. That case says, wherever the officer acts in the exercise of a clearly and purely discretionary authority, his determinations partake of the character of judicial decisions. When these cases talk about quasi-judicial, they're not talking about justices with the black robe hearing cases. What they mean is exercising judgment, exercising discretion. And anybody, whether you're an executive officer, any officer, can exercise judgment, and you're partaking of the character of judicial. So there's that line there. Another case that's been cited in recent cases is the Robinson v. Rohr case, and it was a board of street commissioners determined, adopted plans for the roads. And they talk about the duty of draining the streets and avenues of a city or village is one requiring the exercise of deliberation, judgment, and discretion. This duty is not in a technical sense a judicial one, for it doesn't concern the administration of justice between citizens, but it is of a judicial nature, for it requires the same qualities of deliberation and judgment. When you've got, I don't want you all to read quasi out of the statute. okay? When you are deciding planning sewer systems, planning roads, under any of the tests that are bandied about, that is quasi-legislative. They're not writing laws, but they're planning. They're doing something of a legislative nature.
So, Council,
have you finished answering Justice Bradley's question?
My question was, yes.
He didn't answer it. Okay, because I didn't know exactly what you wanted him to do. I do have questions I'd like to ask, but they're not in the area you're looking at.
So. I didn't understand the question, quite frankly. So I did my best.
Okay. What concerns, you want to try again? Sure.
The purpose of the question is that statement of legislative policy, as I indicated to you, the restatement second that's been codified in 2012, have any application to the facts and law of this case?
No.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. What concerns me is a question similar to what I asked opposing counsel, whether the swimming pool with which Lily was not familiar and for which the City of New Berlin was put on notice that she was a non-swimmer, not familiar with the pool. Does the pool constitute a clear and present danger, then giving New Berlin a ministerial duty in regard to caring for Lily?
Absolutely not. Absolutely
okay, why not?
Under the known danger law, that doesn't rise to the level.
Why not?
Quite frankly, one is the danger wasn't that high. New Berlin's plan and procedure, they've been doing this for years, was to have and invite non-swimmers in there and keep them in the shallow end. Okay, so they've been doing that for years using this same protocol successfully. No other 8-year-old, no other student had wandered into the pool based on the plan. Okay, so a swimming pool is dangerous. It's dangerous for kids. It's dangerous for non-swimmers. But
they
successfully executed it.
Okay, are you saying because they had policies about how to handle non-swimmers, the fact that they did nothing here still doesn't give them liability?
No, I'm saying that the fact that they had policies and procedures is one thing, and they didn't do nothing here. Doing nothing is, you know, there's a 90-foot gorge, and you literally do nothing and let people fall into
it. Well, I think the clear and present danger coming out of Cords came, I think, from Devil's Lake and not marking the other side of bushes, which then was a big drop-off, and somebody fell the other side of the bushes and got hurt. Okay?
So the question is the swim test. Did they do the swim test? Look, here's what New Berlin did. Here's what they did for
I want to know, did they do the swim test?
They were...
It's in their written materials. It's in the pool materials. The mother says, I'm hesitant to let my child go. I don't think she should go. You need to, you know... She's a non-swimmer. They say, no, not to worry. We do a swim test. We watch them. We keep them in the shallow end of the pool. So what exactly did they do to follow up on their word that they were going to do a swim test?
Yeah, here's what they did. They told the kids, including Lily, they said, go through the locker room. If you haven't passed a swim test, if you're new to the program, find a leader and get a swim test before you. They said they did that, and they said also.
So they left it to the 8-year-old to find someone to do a swim test.
Yeah, was that negligent?
Even though they said they would do it.
That might be negligent, and we've got the case, the Bellary case. A promise does not create an otherwise discretionary duty to a ministerial one. Promise doesn't convert it. The Bickney's case also says that. So yeah, they told her. They said, yeah, we swim test them, and they were planning to. And the problem, and this goes back to a big point, so I'm glad you brought this in. The criticism here is of the procedure. It might not have been the best procedure in the world. It might have been a negligent procedure, but it was you have to split the kids up to go through the locker rooms, and they had some counselors to get at the pool, and as the kids got ready, they told them, hey, find a counselor before you get in the water. Find a counselor to do a swim test.
So they only do swim tests on the kids that self-report that they can't swim? That's what the rule says? That's what the documents say?
Yeah, here's the plan. And this is the thing. The documents don't create these hard and fast rules. Their procedure, the protocol that New Berlin had for the Weiberg swim tests was unwritten. It was oral. They've been doing it for 10 years the same way, but they didn't write down
But the 10 years you refer to, did they do the swim test in all those 10 years?
I missed the first word.
I mean, you keep going back to they've been doing the same thing for 10 years. So for 10 years, they haven't done a swim test on kids who are reported non-swimmers?
The procedure was and always had been to have kids, to keep everybody in the shallow end, okay? Everybody, the default is you're going to be kept in the shallow end. If you're a kid and you don't want to be in the shallow end, you say, I would like to go in the deep end. I would like to go down the slide, or I'd like to go on the diving board. And then and they say, okay, if you want to do that, show us that you can swim. And you have to pass the test to prove that you can swim before you're allowed to do any of those
okay,
things.
Okay, so no kids let I've heard different things from you now, so I just want to get in my mind's eye what the reality is. It's not that they self-report as to whether they need a test. No kid is let out of the shallow end until they're tested. Is that what you're saying the procedure is?
Yes.
Okay.
All right, then isn't the issue here the failure to implement the procedure, both the one that you're now telling us is the unwritten procedure and also the written procedures that say things like make sure you know where the kids in your care are at all times, under no circumstances should kids be left alone. So you've got written procedures saying that. You've got your oral procedure about staying in the shallow end. Isn't the issue here not one of what the procedures are, but the actual lack of implementation of those procedures, which would mean that there is not immunity?
No, that's not the issue. The issue is the procedures. The procedure was, as I explained, for the swim testing. That was the way it was supposed to work.
But they didn't do it.
Who didn't do it?
They didn't keep her in the shallow end and then swim test her.
The procedure is for her to go and report. There was a breakdown at that point. And the criticism that we have here is that New Berlin should have had a different procedure in place, and that they should have had a procedure with very small groups such that they have somebody escorting Lily from the locker room to the pool deck.
Well, doesn't that go with ever. Under no circumstances should kids be left alone, make sure you know where the kids in your care are at all times? They didn't know where the kids in their care were. They didn't know where Lily was, right?
Okay, this is another conceptual intellectual problem here that we have in thinking about this. When you say they, okay, let's talk about specific employees. There's a female employee in the locker room with Lily, correct?
Well, I don't know, but there's a point in time where no one knew where Lily was. Right? It doesn't matter who it is. They're all working for New Berlin.
And that's not what the staff guideline says. It says make sure you know where the kids in your custody, or I think it was the word, are.
It says make sure you know where the kids in your care are at all times. So you're saying Lily wasn't in anyone's care?
Correct. The plan was, the problem was in the procedure that called for a handoff. Okay?
All right. So you're saying she wasn't in anyone's care. She was, that's why the procedure wasn't.
The
I'm sorry. I'm just trying to wrap my head around this, and I'm not really.
The procedure calls for Lily to leave the care of the staff person in the locker room who is helping people who need help in the locker room. The procedure, New Berlin's procedure, calls for Lily to then go, and I wish I had the pictures in the record, but to then go over to the shallow end of the pool where the leaders are with their camp T-shirts.
And she's in no one's care. I'm sorry. She's in no one's care from the time she leaves the locker room to the time she gets into the pool.
She is not in the direct care of any staff person. She is expected to at 8 years old, second grade, she's expected to be able to walk from one to the other. And maybe that was negligent. Maybe that's a bad policy. Maybe that's a bad plan that New Berlin had. But nobody got disciplined here, and rightfully so. The staff person in the locker room was not expected to walk Lily over to the person at the pool. The person at the pool was not expected to come get her. All of the staff did exactly what they were supposed to do under the plan. The problem is, according to the plaintiffs, the problem is that the plan had this handoff point, and by the expression that I'm seeing, in hindsight, that's not the best plan. It had worked for for a decade, but here, for some reason, the handoff went awry. But it's not the fault of any particular staff person.
And the pool, being a known place where a child can drown, didn't impose any additional duty or responsibility on those employees.
No.
Especially in light of the fact that they knew she couldn't swim.
No. No. I mean, if you're going to the known danger.
I'm going to the known danger part.
as a, it has to go together with what you're saying. If you're saying that they followed all the procedures, then they have to take into account where those procedures were taking place, and they were in a place where there was a pool where a kid who doesn't swim could drown.
Yeah. They did something. You know, the known danger doctrine is if there's a danger, you have to do something. They did something. They had a plan.
What did they do exactly?
It's what we were talking about. The plan maybe has a defect in it. Maybe it wasn't the best plan in hindsight, but they had a plan. They addressed it. They did something. They didn't sit on their hands. And there's, I mean, they exercise judgment and discretion in deciding how to handle this. And they thought, you've got some kids that take longer in the locker rooms than others. Some have done quicker. So instead of having, you know, one counselor for four or five kids and to keep them together and then walk from the locker room to the pool, they said, okay, when you're done, go find the next person. That was their plan they had, and it had worked successfully. In this case, Lily, for some reason, didn't check in. And so maybe that's a defect in the plan.
Counsel, I'm intrigued by the way you characterize the plaintiff's complaint as finding fault with the plan. I don't read their briefs to support that. It seems to me that they are finding fault with the execution of the plan. They say the plan is there. There is an obligation to supervise. And you failed in supervision. That's not a claim that there was a faulty plan or they should have developed a different plan. It's a claim that you didn't follow the plan. Right?
Well, they're picking different parts of the plan when they talk about that, and they're not acknowledging the protocol, the unwritten part of the protocol. They most certainly are critical of New Berlin's decision not to have somebody escort Lily from the locker room to the pool deck. That was always the way it was intended to happen, though.
Okay, so let me approach it this way. Governmental immunity is an affirmative defense, right?
Yes.
Okay, and so it's your burden to establish immunity. So what act done in the exercise of legislative, quasi-legislative, judicial, or quasi-judicial function are you requesting immunity for? What act?
New Berlin's decision to create a plan and to design a plan to supervise the campers at the Wyberg Pool.
Okay, so let me stop you right there. So if we conclude that plaintiff is not suing you because of the plan you adopted, then you would not be entitled to immunity, correct?
Not correct. I think under the existing law, with as it being a discretionary act immunity, I think any decision in there as far as how to implement it that requires the exercise of discretion or judgment keeps us within immunity.
And that's because you equate discretion with legislative, quasi-legislative, judicial, or quasi-judicial, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And is there an exact correlation between discretionary and those terms? Do they mean exactly the same thing?
As has been said in many of the cases, they say it's synonymous. So I would say yes, the law as it stands, they mean exactly the same.
So let's test that a little bit. So is every discretionary act legislative or judicial or quasi-legislative or quasi-judicial?
I see where you're going with this, and that's interesting for thinking about the law. I think so. I think that's the current state of the law. I think
so
our case is stronger.
Okay, so it's not possible to engage in it for a government employee. It's not possible for them to engage in a discretionary act without it being legislative, quasi-legislative, judicial, or quasi-judicial.
I think so. I think under the current law, I think that's what it means. When you exercise discretion, you're being a little bit like a judge.
Okay. So there's a water cooler back there, and sometimes I go and I get a little bit of water.
You're killing me.
It's discretionary. Is that judicial or quasi-judicial?
Yeah. 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 You're exercising your discretion. Nothing said you had to go get water.
Right. So, and that makes that a judicial or quasi-judicial action?
Yeah, I don't know how you're going to be found, you know, liable for it or immune, but yes, if you're exercising your judgment and there's nothing forcing you to do it ministerially, you know, clear, imperative and all that.
If I do that without my robe on, Is it still judicial or quasi-judicial?
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know what I just conceded there. So again, with a known danger, history of successful outings there, they did something. It might not have been the right thing. It might not have been enough. But they had a plan in place. I want to talk a little bit about the documents. I don't have much time.
But wasn't the plan to, we send our own staff along with the kids, so along with the pool lifeguards, we can ensure a safe swim. We give our own swim tests so we know who the non-swimmers are, so we can keep them in the shallow end of the pool.
Yeah, and the problem is the criticism is the way they did the swim test, okay?
The criticism is there's no swim test.
They were doing swim tests. They were at the pool. Anybody that wanted to go into the deep end raises their hand and say, give me a swim test. She wandered into the pool before waiting for somebody to get that done. So they're saying we should have had a better procedure to make sure she got from the locker room to where she could get a swim test. She wouldn't have asked for that unless she wanted to go in the deep end. So she was supposed to go and find somebody to help her into the pool and stay in the shallow end. Maybe not the greatest plan, but that's a plan, and that's what's being challenged here. If I could just speak quickly to that document, the parental information document, that doesn't create any ministerial duties. That is descriptive, not prescriptive. That document was written by Stuart Bell, who is the same person who had this plan, the way he had always been doing the Wyberg trips. He wrote that plan for the information of the plaintiffs, not to bind New Berlin or staff. Red light.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much.
I kind of tripped all over myself in answering the judicial, legislative, quasi-judicial, quasi-legislative, executive branch.
We have trouble figuring it out, too, so you're not alone.
When you look at the behavior, failure to supervise is not akin to passing an ordinance. It's not akin to denial of a building permit like we see in the Florida line of cases. It's not what Hargrove spoke of. In my humble opinion, it's not what Hewlett spoke of. It has to be one of the three. So then it lends itself to an executive decision. Executive decisions are not immune under the statute. With regard to the county's argument.
Well, Counselor, what if they just, through their policy, decided not to supervise Lily as much as it would have been in her best interest to have them supervise her? Why isn't that quasi-legislative?
Well, the decision to do that is ministerial, and they issued a ruling, and they failed to do that. So
you're saying they created a ministerial duty for themselves by the rules they set up, but they didn't follow them.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. Quickly, with regard to the county's argument, a subsequent legislative approval of a judicial construction is not as probative as the intent of the legislator when it enacted the initial statute. That's Wanky. This court has declared that the Hewlett's rule has been abrogated by case law. That was done in Priest. It's grounded in common law. They cite Zimmerman and say you can't change the rule now because it's been enacted by the legislature. If that's not true or the construction is objectively wrong, and I would argue that from the point in time that Meyer gets back into the case law, those cases are objectively wrong because they abrogate the ruling in Hewlett's.
Counsel, the way that I see it, and then you tell me why I'm wrong, the way that I see it is we started out in 1975 the Wisconsin Supreme Court, interpreting what quasi-legislative, judicial, and quasi-judicial means. And we said, okay, we have this discretionary versus ministerial. So those are the phraseology. That's the phraseology we've used since 1975. One of the very first cases I wrote when I came to this court on behalf of the court, Estate versus Kavanaugh, which is cited in the briefs, you know, talks about the difference between ministerial and discretionary. And we've used that nomenclature. In fact, I was looking at some of our recent opinions, and they have headings, you know, Roman numeral number 3, ministerial duty. And we use the same words. Now, we may apply it differently, and I agree that sometimes application of the test is subject to some concern. But the test itself has been around, and it is just stare decisis 101. Why am I wrong on that? I mean, I've used that since 1976. I used to represent municipalities, and Lister came out in 75.
Well, while the terms have been around, I think the definition and the application of those terms have been all over the board. And when a party asks this court to overturn a prior interpretation of a statute, I think it's got a burden to show that this decision was objectively wrong. And this court has done that before. And I think in this case, that's what we have here. I think we have an objectively wrong standard based on Meyer coming back into the rule of law post-Politz. And this court is, stare decisis obviously is an important precedent, but it isn't immovable. And I would argue that in this case, it needs to be moved. Quickly, I don't understand some of the points that were brought up by New Berlin. The SWIM test is a written test. It's a rule that has been applied not only by New Berlin, but it was New Berlin incorporated it from the Weiberg rules. You don't do a SWIM test after the girl is in the water. It defies logic.
Conclude. Give yourself a sentence or two.
What I am struck by is that some 40, 50, 60 years later, we've got a situation where Politz is not being followed, and in no case, with discretion being so broad, it's difficult to fathom a fact scenario where this tort can be actionable at the lower court level, and I just don't believe that was the intent of Politz or the statute.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much for a very good argument on a rather sad case for everyone, I'm sure. We are going to take a break now, and we'll return for our third case of the day at 1:30. We are adjourned.